Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, Mike.
Yeah, Matty.
What's the taxonomy for Homo sapiens or humans?
Okay, it starts at domain, and our domain is eukarya. Then it goes to kingdom, which is animalia. Then it goes to phylum, which is chordata. And then it goes to class, which is mammalia.
Stop. Mammal time.
Welcome, everybody, to Dr. Matt and Dr. Mark's Medical Podcast. Today, we're talking about mammals, but specifically, we're talking about mammaries.
Well,
mammaries and mammary glands is what allows us to be classified within that class of mammals. We're talking about breastfeeding and lactation. Do you know why we're talking about breastfeeding and lactation today, Matt?
Well, I'm guessing because you just had a baby.
I did. I had a little baby.
Congratulations,
girl.
Mike.
Thanks, mate. I had a little...
And all the listeners are stoked for you. I can hear them now.
Applauding?
Yes.
Cheering, crying?
Well, that's either background noise or applauding. I'm not sure.
I think
what.
It's the air conditioner.
Air conditioner.
So, yeah, had a little baby girl last week. Baby Tia.
Tia. What do you call her?
Tia Todorovic, because it's TT, we call her Titty.
Titties, yeah. Which is also
and my little... Yeah, perfect for today.
So, Titty... And new baby, so we're going to talk about the breast.
Talk about the breast, breastfeeding, lactation, anatomy, physiology, and so forth.
Anything else of importance today?
Well, we're going to have a special guest today.
Wow.
And our special guest is a midwife and a nurse, and she's going to help us
talk
about...
Big hospital in Brisbane?
Yes, absolutely. She's going to help us talk about breastfeeding for the expecting mother, or maybe the currently breastfeeding mother, such as my partner.
So that's not our area of expertise, so we're going to bring in an expert to talk about that side of things.
Yeah, so Rose will come in after we talk a bit about anatomy and physiology and talk about some of the social implications of breastfeeding.
Right.
So let's start with the anatomy. Let's start with the embryological development of the breast. What do you think?
Well, actually, I would prefer to...
We should prepare. I think before we do a podcast, we should sit down and have a conversation about what we're going to talk about. So, what would you like to do, Matt?
What I'd like to do? Well, I always ask myself, or at least for the last week.
So, for the last week, you've asked yourself?
Particularly with Titty coming into the world.
Yeah, little Titty.
Little Tia.
Yeah.
Why do you think animals need breasts? I mean, like, I just wonder why do you think we evolved to need to have breast and breastfeeding and lactation?
I just assumed it was a way to feed the young.
Yeah, so obviously, as you went through at the start, all like life on Earth starts kind of in the domain. So for us, we have a nucleus and then we become animals. Obviously plants and so forth, and then we go to chordata, which is vertebrates, but then we get to our one, which is mammals. So why did mammals split off, or what selected for them to become
Oh, so now we're talking about evolutionary biology.
Yeah, yeah.
So what made mammals, mammals, and other classes, whatever they may be.
Exactly. So what was the selection for needing to lactate? So my question to you, Michael.
Yeah, go on.
Breasts.
Yes.
Are obviously in the... what's the word for studying the bones and all that stuff?
Studying bones?
Yeah, like in fossil records.
Like archaeology.
Archaeology, there you go.
That's so, not the study of bones.
Isn't it?
No, archaeology is just... Isn't it just
study of the bones, but just looking at fossil records to see, you know, certain traits and so forth of evolution and so forth.
Okay.
Now, obviously, with the breast, it's soft tissue, so you're not going to really be able to... find that in fossil records too well.
Oh, good point. Yeah.
So it's a harder thing to kind of establish.
Yeah.
But there's hypotheses out there of suggesting what the advantage is. So for maybe from a histological point of view, where do you think the breast or the breast tissue came from, evolved from?
Don't know.
Developed from?
Well, is the breast tissue always located on the anterior? So, or I should not say anterior, the ventral surface of mammal or mammals, or the mammaries on the ventral surface.
I think there's a mammal line that runs down the anterior surface or the ventral surface of mammals, or at least as far as I'm aware,
conserved?
There's potentially exceptions to it, but I think there is a line that runs down. So, in animals, that we have this line where the nipples or the teats will sit.
Mm.
So I think that's possible, but I guess what I was getting at is the breast actually developed out of an accessory part of the skin.
Okay.
So it's an accessory organ or an accessory
gland.
Gland, exactly, of the skin. So it's actually designed to secrete something, just like you would say have sweat, or you would secrete oil.
So is it like a modified sebaceous or?
Yeah, like
ecrine
that.
Gland yeah, of so some
they,
sort.
So they hypothesize that it's either a modified sweat or sebaceous, or like an oil gland.
Yeah.
And now it's thought as we've transitioned into mammals, so let's say from egg-laying animals, both males and females, so both sexes, had this modified gland, and it really just secreted certain... antibodies or antimicrobial agents.
So you're saying egg-laying animals, which you're saying evolutionarily speaking are older than us. So you're saying prior to mammals,
right?
We had egg-laying animals. We still do, but
reptiles, birds.
They're older, older in the evolutionary sense.
Right,
and you're saying that they've got some modified glands of some sort, or at least they had some modified glands of some sort. I don't know if they still do, which secreted what?
Antibodies. Antibodies,
yeah,
or antimicrobial agents. And so what the baby would be born, new hatchling, snuggle up to mum, snuggle up to dad, probably lick or somehow ingest these secretions.
Yeah.
And it would kind of prime their immune system, protect them from the outside world.
So it wasn't a nutritional thing?
No, not nutrition at all.
Oh.
And so that was the primary benefit of this type of secretion. And so then what I would imagine is some animals would have... produced a greater volume of this secretion, and so then it would have become a nutrition source, and so then the advantage would have been, as a baby, you're now licking or suckling or ingesting this fluid, which is not only beneficial to stop you getting sick, infected, but also priming your immune system, probably also priming your gastrointestinal tract, like with good flora, but then now giving you some nutrition. And so now we look to certain animals that are the bridge. So what's the bridge between the mammals and the egg layers? We have those. We have these animals that lay an egg.
Monotremes.
So monotremes.
Like echidnas.
Yeah, so they're in Australia, I think, only exclusively, aren't they?
Monotremes?
Yeah,
I think so. What are they? Echidnas and a platypus?
Platypus, yeah.
They
yeah.
lay eggs, but they also have mammary glands.
Yeah, so it's not actually mammary glands per se, it's kind of like a milk patch.
Okay.
So it's just an area where milk kind of just comes out of the skin, and the babies kind of have a odd shaped nose. I'm not looking at you, Michael.
Oh, well, thanks, mate.
Waiting
for that.
And just ingests that fluid for a period of time.
And for both nutritional and immunological benefit.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And a really interesting part of that is they found that if you, as a newborn,
okay, yeah,
if you can now ingest milk for, let's say, a year, 2 years, you don't require to develop permanent teeth to then, to ingest foods, to break down foods, etc.
Yeah.
So the advantage of that, if you don't need to put your permanent teeth out, your skull isn't set in its size. So, therefore, the baby has the capacity to expand its skull for the next year or so.
So if teeth have to grow early, then it means it's basically like laying the concrete and setting the size of the skull.
Right.
It can't get any bigger once the permanent teeth are in.
Yeah, that's right.
But if the teeth take a little bit longer to get in, then skull's more malleable, can get a little bit larger.
Exactly.
So you're saying that for us coming out as newborns,
which were probably undeveloped, really, if you think about it.
Well, if you look at us coming out at, after 9 months or so, the only reason why we come out after 9 months is we all actually come out premature. I mean, we talk about preemie babies coming out at some point prior to that 9 months. But in actual fact, if you look at us evolutionarily speaking, we're all premature because we were supposed to be inside the womb for far longer than we currently are. And the reason why we come out earlier is because of the fact that throughout our evolutionary history, we went from being on all fours,
yep,
having an open pelvis, larger pelvis, to standing upright, which has shifted our pelvis. And shifting the pelvis has meant that the room, in order to push that bub out, has diminished.
Right.
And so the bub has to come out a little bit earlier so that they can fit, which means bub's coming out basically premature, which is one of the reasons why, as mammals, have a look at other mammals when they're born. They come out, they stumble for a little bit, and they're walking. They're moving around. They're quite, they are defenseless in a way. But I mean, they still can move and they can run and they can jump and they can do whatever they need to do. But if I took a little Tia and I were to put her in the corner of the room and I were to do something for an hour and come back, she's still sitting in the corner of the room. She's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
She's defenseless. She can't do anything.
Yeah.
And so we need to have this milk. We need to help them develop.
Yeah.
We need to let their skulls grow.
Which is important for brain growth and brain size, which is more intelligence and so forth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, we also need to talk, we need to preface this podcast today with a couple of things. First thing is that Matt and I are scientists and we teach anatomy and physiology. And when we're talking about breastfeeding and lactation, the impetus to do this podcast was obviously me having a baby and my bub breastfeeding at the moment from my partner.
Partner, not Michael.
not me, unfortunately. We'll talk about the fact that maybe earlier on I could have lactated.
Yeah,
we'll talk about
the
history of that. but I think we need to talk about the fact that we just want to talk about the anatomy and physiology of breastfeeding and lactation.
Mm.
And we're not talking about this in a way that puts pressure on anybody. We don't want to stigmatize anybody who doesn't breastfeed or cannot breastfeed. We understand the fact that not everyone has the ability to breastfeed and that
definitely.
Many people find it far more difficult than others to breastfeed. We just want to talk about it from a simple biological standpoint. So we're going to talk about the benefits of breastfeeding. We're going to talk about any detriments or side effects or contraindications of breastfeeding. We just want to talk about how it happens. We're not laying any judgment whatsoever. That's not our job. That's not what we want to do. Okay?
Well,
you agree,
said.
Matt?
Well said.
Okay. In saying that, let's now talk about the embryological development of the breast.
So I think just before we get to that, because I just didn't get to finish before you butted in and spoke about your own breastfeeding.
Go on.
I really just wanted to say, which really shocked me when I was looking into this,
yeah,
was probably the primary function or the primary first selection of lactation was its immune benefit.
Yeah.
So for survival of priming the immune system for the newborn, making it strong, but also probably now, given a certain constituents for the baby's gastrointestinal system to promote the most advantageous biota or the bacteria, which would be probably the most beneficial for the baby.
Okay.
So that's what I found really amazing. And then nutrition kind of came secondary.
So nutrition was secondary to the
real
benefits.
Immune side of things.
Okay.
And so it's
interesting because we always think about it as being, well, if somebody is breastfeeding and solely breastfeeding, so they're not providing any supplements. We always think about it as being there as a nutritional means for the bub,
yeah,
primarily, as opposed to immunological.
Super, super, super important.
Yeah.
But I was just really shocked on it actually first started with its immune side. So we know that, you know, there is the transplacental migration of antibodies across into the baby in utero.
Yeah.
But then they're not getting that anymore, so it's coming now from the mother. And also, it's important for lining all the surfaces of where the milk would come into the baby with protecting the mucosa.
So all those mucosal membranes, such as going from the mouth down the esophagus to the intestines, yep, and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's my part?
Yeah.
That's cool?
Yeah.
Okay. So now in terms of embryology, so how it actually developed in us.
Yeah.
So basically at about, I'll be guessing, about 8 weeks, it's just come from the skin. So it's a skin derivative. So the skin comes from the ectoderm in the baby, or the utero, in utero. And so the actual start of the mammal gland is just a bud, like a condensation of ectoderm just on the front surface of the baby.
Yeah.
And then what happens is a duct system kind of goes into the body, and that's just like a one or two ductal parts.
So just some hollow tubes.
Yeah, nothing really changes. But then as the mother's hormones increase, so placental hormones, so these, what placental hormones would these be, Mike?
Oh, these would be progesterone, estrogen.
Mm.
Yep.
They start to go up. Prolactin starts to go up. So the actual baby's breast starts to develop this way as well. So they start to get certain ductal formations.
Oh, from the progesterone and estrogen that are...
mother.
So strangely enough, while mother has bub in utero,
yeah,
the progesterone and estrogen that are being produced from the placenta,
yeah,
isn't just helping the early the lactogenesis of the mother's breast,
right,
but is also helping the embryological development of the baby's breast.
Yeah, that's right.
Male and female?
Male and female.
Okay,
And so when the baby's born, the baby's highly exposed to all the mother's hormones. So there is potential that the baby can, really early, lactate.
Male or female?
Male or female.
And that at what stage? Like, as soon as they're born?
Yeah, basically as soon as they're born.
But what would be the stimulus?
That's all the hormones from the mother.
Okay.
And so that's called, I think they call that witch's milk. I'm not sure where that came from.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. So as soon as the baby's born, then the placenta follows and the mother's hormones shift and the baby loses those ductal systems and it kind of regresses back.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically the sexes are the same. So male and female's breast is almost identical up to puberty.
Okay.
Right?
Because they are hormonally driven.
Hormonally.
Should we make the statement? Should we highlight to the listeners about from where and at what stage progesterone and estrogen are released from individuals? So, because we need to talk about, so throughout the menstrual cycle, estrogen and progesterone are produced. So estrogen is produced from primary, secondary follicles.
Right.
And progesterone is produced from the corpus luteum once ovulation has occurred.
Which is like the eggshell.
Which is like the eggshell, basically. So, which means that estrogen's produced quite early on in the menstrual cycle.
Yeah.
So, from between day 2-ish up until around about day 13-ish, you've got some estrogen that's been released.
Mm.
Then you've got progesterone being released at around about day 14 onwards for about 10 days to about day 24. And this release through the menstrual cycle, does this have any effect on breast development?
For the
individual just going through puberty?
For the female going through puberty? Yes, yes.
Okay.
That's right, exactly. So just pause 1 second. There are to actually have the physiology of lactation, I just want to point this out now. There's 4 main hormones involved.
Okay.
There's estrogen, there's progesterone, there's prolactin, and there's oxytocin.
All right.
So just keep them in mind, listeners. And we'll get to them. And all those 4 put together gives you a mature breast and actually the ability to actually finally produce milk.
So do you want to do a quick soundbite as to very generally what each of those hormones do? I know that especially for estrogen and progesterone, their function is quite broad.
Okay.
But what about prolactin and oxytocin?
Well, a lot of it's in the name. So start with progesterone.
Yeah.
Progestation.
Yeah.
So it's supporting gestation. So that's pregnancy.
Thickens the uterine lining, right, and gets the endometrium ready for implantation.
Yep, allows it to implant and stay implanted.
Okay.
Estrogen, I'm not sure what that word derives from, but it's...
Oh, good job.
It's an own. So it's
I thought you were great. I thought you loved your Latin derivatives.
So it's like testosterone. So it's androgen-based steroid. Anyway, yep. So move to prolactin. It's in the name again. So prolactation.
Yeah.
Okay, and then oxytocin. And then Mike will explain that word, oxytocin.
Will I? Will I explain it?
Anyway.
Are you going to explain oxytocin?
I don't know either.
But you haven't said what oxytocin does.
Oh, oxytocin is the milk let down, so it actually gets the milk out of the breast.
So the difference between prolactin and oxytocin is that prolactin helps to produce the milk and oxytocin helps to eject the milk.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Very good.
Thank you.
Excellent, Michael. So back to the puberty state of the female.
Yep.
Estrogen, which is, as you said, is secreted from the oocyte, the developing oocytes.
Yep.
So that's the developing eggs.
Yeah.
Each menstrual cycle. Okay. So the follicular stage. Okay. So this is going to bump up the estrogen levels. What happens here in puberty is estrogen primarily has an effect on elongating, so lengthening the ductal system in the breast.
Yep.
So they're the things that carry the milk.
Okay.
They might be also known as lactiferous ducts or milk ducts, but also promotes fat adipose tissue in the breast. And this gives the breast the bulk. So women,
how much of the bulk? Oh, you say the bulk, but
80 to 85% of the size of the breast is fat.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so women who have larger breasts, it's generally because of fat content, adipose content.
Gotcha.
Okay, which is more strongly selected for by estrogen.
But when it comes to breastfeeding, that fat content or the size has no difference.
No difference. So a female with smaller breasts, she should not feel that she is incapable of lactating or breastfeeding. She has the same amount of lobules or
milk-producing cells.
Yeah, milk-producing primary areas.
Cool.
As a female with a larger breast.
Okay.
Okay, so that's what estrogen does.
Yeah.
Progesterone, which comes in the latter half of the menstrual cycle, it actually causes the ductal system to branch out, producing the milk-producing cells, which is in the what we call the alveoli. This is not in your lungs. Alveoli just means kind of dilated ducts.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
So that's the main hormones that develop the breast. And then obviously, as you move through puberty, or the female moves through puberty, breast gets larger, etc., and then have the capacity to be able to produce milk.
Okay, so let's then say that a female gets pregnant.
One final thing.
Yeah.
The other thing the breast does have in the female is what we call Cooper ligaments, which gives, on the upper portion of the breast, it gives the breast support, particularly once it starts to produce milk and it stops it hanging down, I guess.
So where are their attachments?
Their attachments is across to the skin. So it kind of comes across and attaches to the front kind of fascia of the breast.
Mm.
At, so the most anterior front part of the breast, just under the skin.
Yeah.
And moves back through the ductal system, supporting all the ducts.
Yeah.
Because there's 15 to 20 ductal lobes in the breast.
So is it attached to the pectoral or not?
The fascia of the pecs. So in your pec muscles, okay, it kind of attaches to their fascia.
Okay.
Now the reason why I'm saying that is because it holds the breast and that gives the shape of female breasts. So the shape of their breast, not the size, is due to these ligaments.
What are they called?
They're called
Cooper's.
Cooper's ligaments.
Okay.
And finally, this is just a clinical point, if there was to be a primary tumour, or breast cancer, sometimes the cancer actually will cause these ligaments to become taut and that will retract the skin. And sometimes the early sign of breast cancer is kind of dimpling or the breast starts to have...
Shifting.
Not shifting, but it kind of has indentations kind of in it. And that can be a sign of breast cancer because of the ligaments.
Okay. That's interesting.
All right. So let's now say that the mother or the female is pregnant.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's say that obviously there's been a fertilized egg implanted into the endometrium.
Yep.
What's happened is that obviously, for a short period of time, the progesterone and estrogen is still being produced by that corpus luteum up until the point in which the placenta is now sufficient, and the placenta now is what's taking over in regards to producing progesterone and estrogen.
Yeah, and high amounts of it.
High amounts. Now, does this have an effect on... So, the mother's obviously gone through puberty because she's now pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the mother's breast needs to get prepared for milk production for when bub's born.
Yeah.
So, how do the levels of estrogen and progesterone, and maybe prolactin and oxytocin as well, what's going on there with those hormone levels to really get the breast ready for parturition, for when bub's out?
Okay. So, as far as I'm aware, the high levels of progesterone and estrogen will go up into the hypothalamus, mm-hmm. which is some deep structures of the brain.
Yeah, master control center of the endocrine system.
Yep, and the anterior pituitary gland, which produces prolactin. So, I think they're called lactotroph cells, mm-hmm. meaning trophic means growth. Mm-hmm. So, lac growth cells. And the estrogen progesterone goes to them and tells them to kind of, look, something's developing here. We need some prolactin, please.
Okay.
And I think also, generally the hypothalamus, correct me if I'm wrong here, Mike, but I think generally...
I always do.
I think the hypothalamus, I think this pathway is the only one where there's constant inhibition. Otherwise, if you take off the inhibition of the hypothalamus, prolactin would just release.
Yeah, because there's prolactin inhibiting... signals. Yeah,
which is dopamine, I think. I think that's dopamine from the hypothalamus causes the inhibition of the prolactin cells in the pituitary gland.
Mm-hmm.
So, not only does the estrogen progesterone tell the anterior pituitary to start secreting more prolactin, but I think it also inhibits that inhibitor from the hypothalamus.
Okay.
So, prolactin starts to bump up now.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what prolactin will do, prolactation... it starts to develop, I guess, the actual milk-producing cells in those alveoli or lobules of the breast.
Okay.
And so it primes it,
yeah.
gets it ready. However, what does progesterone do to prolactin before the baby's born?
What?
It inhibits the actual secretion. So there's not actually... probably minus a bit of... leak.
So, we need to define secretion versus excretion here. When we say secretion, milk secretion, we're not talking about it coming out of the nipple. Milk secretion is simply milk production in the mammary glands.
Hmm.
Milk excretion is milk ejection from the mammary glands.
Okay.
So, when Matt says it inhibits milk secretion, it means the high levels of progesterone that's coming from the placenta is actually inhibiting milk production at this point, which means that milk... production will only finalize. So what's happening at the moment with these levels of progesterone and estrogen, prolactin and so forth, is that the breast is getting ready to produce milk,
yeah.
but it's not producing milk yet. It will only do it once these high progesterone levels have dropped. Which means, how are these high progesterone levels going to drop? The placenta needs to disappear.
That's right.
So that means once parturition has occurred and bub's out, placenta comes with it.
Yep.
And once that placenta's gone, progesterone levels significantly drop about tenfold, and then takes a couple of days, 3-4 days, so 48, 72 or so hours before the milk production occurs. And this is why after bub's been born, it takes a couple of days for milk to come through.
Yeah,
this is what we realized when Kel obviously gave birth to little Tia.
Tia. So I think there might be slight leakages during pregnancy for the female,
yep.
but generally the volume won't be there.
Yeah.
So as you said, once the baby's born and then the placenta is delivered shortly after,
mm-hmm.
that the high levels of estrogen, but particularly progesterone, is out of the mother's blood system now, and the prolactin is now full dominant, and now milk secretion can occur.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, so we've got these alveoli cells, which are producing the actual milk constituents.
Mm-hmm.
So they are little cube-like cells
yep.
that are located at the kind of the distal end or the top end of the ducts.
Yeah.
And they will produce... it's not like milk isn't just a homogenized solution.
Okay.
It comes out in parts.
Yeah.
Okay. So the prolactin Well, what we should probably say here, something has to further tell the mother's endocrine system or nervous system that there is a demand for milk.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
So there's something that the baby has to do to then drive this process further.
So to get milk to come out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So suckling.
Suckling.
Yes.
So that would tell you in on the breast, in the breast, around the external breast, the areola, which is kind of that. So you got the nipple and you got the plate. How do you describe it?
Yeah.
The round plate, which is a darker color.
Yeah.
Particularly that color should darken in pregnancy compared to what it was before pregnancy. So in that, there's a very rich area of nerve cells, mechanico nerve cells.
That's right.
And so once the baby starts to suckle, it stimulates this.
Sends afferent signals up to the hypothalamus, telling the hypothalamus, hey, tell the posterior pituitary gland to release oxytocin.
Yeah, so now this is different. So this is where the final one comes in, which is oxytocin.
Mm. Which is there for milk ejection.
Right, or that sometimes they call that milk letdown.
Yeah.
Okay, so now what happens is around the alveoles, so we've got the big ducts, and at the end of the ducts, we have the lobules and alveoli, okay? But around the outside of those are these special muscle cells, okay? And they squeeze these ducts like contractions.
Mm.
And so this
like
is...
like a baster. When you're basting something, you get the little pump at the end of it, and you squeeze that and starts to push stuff out of it. The oxytocin tells that muscle to contract, to squeeze everything out. Which makes sense because oxytocin also tells the uterus to contract when it's time to give birth.
So
oxytocin plays a role in smooth muscle contraction.
Brilliant. Yeah. So when...
It's positive feedback too, Matthew. Positive feedback system.
What does
that mean? Well, negative feedback is once the effector comes into play. So once you've produced, let's say, oxytocin... let's talk about temperature regulation.
Okay.
If we talk about temperature regulation, let's say you go outside, it's cold, and what do you do is the cold temperature is the stimulus, tells your temperature receptors it's cold, sends a signal to the brain, goes, bloody hell, it's cold, what should I do to warm up again? And you shiver, and then you negate the initial stimulus.
Oh,
that's
goes
negative
the
feedback.
Way.
Goes the opposite way.
Right.
Positive feedback, you exacerbate the stimulus.
Right.
So for oxytocin release... with the suckling...
Makes more milk.
More oxytocin. Once baby stops suckling, that's where the stimulus stops.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So it's basically driven by demand. So
yep.
More milk out, the more production of milk.
That's right.
Okay. So the baby latches on to the lateral margins of the nipple around the areola.
Yep.
And causes a mechanical stimulus, which goes... through the breast into the thoracic wall, up into the brain, goes to the hypothalamus and tells the hypothalamus that there is some activity down there. So it then goes to a different part of the pituitary gland. This time it's posterior to secrete oxytocin.
Yep.
Oxytocin then goes to the breast, which causes contraction of those muscle cells, which pushes the milk out.
Yep.
Is that right?
Perfect.
Brilliant.
Now, should we talk... So we're talking milk... But remember that once bub comes out, for the first couple of days, colostrum.
What is that? I don't know what that is.
So colostrum is basically this nutrient-rich fluid. Now, compared to milk, it's got less lactose and basically no fat, but it's easily digestible and it helps the baby to survive until that milk comes in after a couple of days.
Mm.
So that's what that colostrum is. So this thin, cloudy fluid that the mammary glands produce.
I think so. It's got important...
Which my bub spewed up a lot of.
Did it?
And it's quite yellowy in substance. Yeah.
So I think it primes the gastrointestinal tract like we spoke about before.
Yeah.
It can select for certain good bacteria to then promote further digestion, probably for the milk digestion to come. But interestingly, and you might have found this anecdotally with you, the colostrum has like a laxative effect. As well, so it causes it causes the baby to pass the first stool, I believe, which is the
meconium.
Meconium, yeah,
yeah, and that's this black, tarry, sticky. I've never seen anything as sticky as this, and it comes out. A lot of it comes out,
okay.
And so that meconium came out for a couple of days, about two or three days. And then once the milk came through, which is after, I'd say after 3 to 4 days, Kel's milk came through, and then the color of the poo drastically changed from this black tar to this greeny color to then what looks like a mustardy yellow with chunks of what looks like curdled milk.
Oh, wow.
And it begins to smell a little bit.
Great imagery.
Well, so this is life, isn't it?
So I think that leads us to our last point before we bring the expert in on just the main constituents of the milk itself.
Yeah.
So from my understanding, there's kind of like if you picture the cells that produce the milk, they're little box-shaped cells.
Yeah.
Okay. On their base, so on their bottom surface is where you have, say, the blood vessels, which is going to bring all the nutrients in. And on the other surface is where the actual constituents come out and goes into the ducts, which then is squeezed out through the help of oxytocin out to through the nipple into the mouth of the baby.
Right.
Now, so there's like a five separate pathway systems that produce the constituents for the milk.
Okay.
So it's not like it just shoots out like a white fluidy stuff that you see in a bottle of cow's milk. It actually comes in kind of different parts. So there's like a fatty part, there's the aqueous part, there's the immune part, there's the ion part.
Okay, so let's go through it bit by bit then. The immune part, primarily composed of immunoglobulin A, right?
Yes.
Now, immunoglobulin A is, you know, you got immunoglobulin Gs and Es and so forth. And
some of the listeners might know really what these are,
yeah.
But they're antibodies?
Antibodies, they prime the immune system, get them ready for... So, as an example, immunoglobulin A will prime our granulated immune cells. So these are all the fills, right? All the white blood cells that end in fill, like eosinophils, basophils, and so forth. They've got granules inside.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And what happens is IgAs prime these cells to burst. And when they release, they stimulate the immune system to start phagocytosing, eating up pathogens, anything that shouldn't be there. That's one thing that it does. But it also helps line the mucosal surfaces and helps prepare that for immunological response. That's what IgA does.
And probably also because the mother's lived, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, she has memory to many infections.
Yeah.
Many bacteria, many viruses, many harmful things. And so she's got immunity against it already. And so the baby hasn't, it's just been born.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So the baby's now exposed to all these harmful things.
Yeah.
And so the baby could be exposed to... Because we're always exposed to things, but our immune system just knocks it off without us becoming sick. So, therefore, the mother is now producing these specialized antibodies to be shot out through the milk to help the baby's immune system to fight off these infections.
Yeah.
That's fair?
That's fair.
And so this is one pathway, and this is kind of a transcellular pathway, which is straight across the cell into the ducts.
Okay. What else is produced?
Another one is like the aqueous pathway, which has got the proteins, the milk proteins, which is, I think, casein.
Yeah, casein's the major milk protein.
Okay. It's also got lactose in there.
Yeah.
It's also got...
But lactose is a sugar.
It's sugar. And it's also got calcium in there. Okay.
And we need to state that the lactose concentration drastically changes when you're shifting from the earlier phases of milk production to the later phases of milk production. So you start off with little lactose and move into greater
much
amounts
more?
Of lactose. Okay. Yeah, that's right. So you have these rapid changes that are occurring in the first 4 days. And so you get this change in permeability of the paracellular pathways, and it results in a shift from high concentrations of sodium and chloride and protective immunoglobulins and lactoferrin, but there's little lactose and there's no casein in the colostrum. So the first couple of days. That's right.
So a lot more proteins.
Yes, that's right. And then as we move through past day four into day five, when you're getting the proper amount of milk that's coming through, so starting off from about 100 mils in the first 24 hours to about 500 mils after about 5 days, that's when you start getting increased lactose. So increased sugars, increased proteins, and decreased sodium, decreased chloride, and so forth.
Right, okay. So we've got the proteins, we've got the sugars, we've got calcium, we spoke about the immunoglobulins, but then we've also got fat. So there's these globules of fat that get kind of secreted off into little blobs, fat blobs.
Yeah.
Okay, and they get popped off into the milk as well.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to note that in a feed, So when little Tia is feeding, as the oxytocin's being secreted from her suckling, the ducts has already got milk in it, or fluid in it, and probably the start of the feed is more aqueous, so it's much more watery.
It is, yeah,
and
absolutely. So
the fat comes a bit later on.
That's right.
And so the start of the feed...
You can tell that. You can tell.
So the start of the feed should be more fluidy, and then the latter feed would be much thicker.
Yes.
And so that would give the baby the feeling of fullness, which is called... What's the word for that?
What?
Fullness.
Satiated.
Yeah, okay, that's... I just couldn't pronounce it.
You can't pronounce a lot of words.
I know. Okay, and anything else?
Well, I think what we'll do is we'll leave some of the other stuff for when Rose comes in, and we'll have a discussion about breastfeeding, lactation, and some of the social implications and some of the
pros and cons. Pretty much the AMP, would you say?
I think we've covered pretty much the AMP.
How the breasts were selected for out of evolution, I think that was really interesting.
Yeah.
That it was
if you
primarily
do say so yourself.
That was primarily driven by its immune benefit.
Not and its then nutritional
and then
benefit.
Nutrition came second. How it evolved, how it came about in the embryo. Yeah. So the sexes were the same, and then puberty and so forth changed. How lactation occurred in a physiology point of view. But I've got a quick question before we get our expert in.
Yeah.
Do males, so the male sex, can we lactate, Michael?
I think given the right stimulus, yes.
Yeah. Good.
How? So, what is the stimulus?
So, in some species, I think there is one species, a bat in Malaysia, that can lactate and will lactate for the young.
Yeah.
Okay. But
Male bat.
But I think there are some species of livestock that have been inbred to a degree, like goats and so forth, that the male goat can actually lactate.
And what's the stimulus? Do they need progesterone and estrogen to prepare
the
glands?
They need still the hormonal activation and so forth. But I do believe, I haven't investigated this deeply.
No, typical.
But
how's this for evidence-based research, guys?
But I did read that in a starvation state, and then once we go from a starvation state into a fed state, there is a poor imbalance of the hormones.
Okay.
Because the liver's really been knocked out. Mm. And so, therefore, the liver's not controlling the hormonal balance. And so, in males, the glandular tissue recovers very quickly. The liver doesn't so. So, in the males, we have estrogen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Of course.
And so, therefore, I'd imagine the estrogen levels in the male is
boost
higher,
a little bit,
and that will cause prolactin release, and then they can actually lactate to a degree.
Wow. Okay.
So there is potential for males because we have all the anatomy, all the parts to it. We just, I guess, have turned it off because there's no benefit for a male to lactate, I guess, for survival.
Yeah, makes sense.
All right, Mike, I think it's time for the expert. What do you reckon?
Yes, we now have joining us Rose Townley. Now, Rose is a clinical midwife at Mater Mothers Hospital in Brisbane and a registered nurse. She's got a Bachelor of Midwifery and a Bachelor of Nursing and an immunisation certificate and is an adjunct tutor. Welcome, Rose.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Now, we wanted to have a discussion about breastfeeding for mothers and for bub. And I just wanted to start off by saying that I was reading that the World Health Organization recommends that exclusive breastfeeding, so that's breastfeeding without supplements or anything like that, should be for the first 6 months and continued through to at least 12 months with subsequent weaning as a mutual decision by both mum and bub. And that historical and physioanthropological data actually suggests that it's only been the past 100 years that we have breastfed children below 3 to 4 years of age. We've actually breastfed children for many years. Now, from your experience, from what you know, how feasible is it to, first of all, breastfeed a child for 6 months to 12 months? And is it even feasible to breastfeed a child up to 3 to 4 years?
Well, answer is yes to all of those questions. Like, ideally, it's preferable that women breastfeed up until the age of 6 months. And if they can go further than that, that's ideal for the mother and the baby. So ideally 12 months. It's not always the case. There's a number of factors that can come into play, whether a woman can breastfeed for that long or whether they can breastfeed at all or whether they can only breastfeed for a very short period of time. I think the important thing there is if they can do it, you know, we do encourage it, and we want to support women in their choice of breastfeeding, or if they can't support them in their other methods that they can provide nutrition to their children.
So how important is it, as soon as Bub's born, what is there a time frame in which Bub needs to get onto the boob in order to stimulate lactation and promote breastfeeding? Is there a window in which if it's missed, nothing's going to happen?
There, ideally, it is preferable to get baby straight onto mum's chest straight after delivery,
yep,
where they can have a bit of skin to skin that helps to stimulate the hormones and then start that whole routine reflex that the babies have. So they then are searching for the breast and have that first feed. We do find that first feed is the most effective feed for the baby, and then there may be a slight decline for a very short period of time, but then they establish that breastfeeding. But saying that, if a woman can't breastfeed straight away with their baby, that's not going to stop them from lactating.
Okay.
Okay.
So is there, because just from my experience, obviously, N equals one, mm-hmm, last week, little baby Tia coming along. Kel went through every sort of labor possible. Every sort of procedure trying to get Bub out. So she had about a 20-hour labor, tried to deliver naturally, tried to push. Nothing's coming out. Bub was OP, so flipped around the other way, looking upwards, tried to do a forcep delivery, wasn't happening. Bub's just not fitting that way. Then went out the sunroof, C-section, and as soon as Bub came out, I grabbed a hold of her, and she started trying to suckle at my breast, and we put Bub straight onto mum, and she started suckling, thankfully. Now, from what you see, do most babies have this suckling reflex as soon as they're out? Or is it quite variable from what you see from bub to bub?
It can vary depending on a number of factors. So things like gestation. So are they, effectively a preterma that's been delivered? Or are they, term baby or overdue? There can be a number of different things. Things that have happened in the delivery can have potentially an effect on initiating that first feed.
So it's stress. If it's been a stressful delivery, or mum's been stressed or bub's stressed, it may impact whether they latch.
And you've got babies, there's some babies that will have a terrific first feed and then they're really sleepy and they're really hard to feed for that first 24 hours and then they wake up and go, oh, okay, I know what I'm doing now, and they get on with the job of feeding. And there's other babies that aren't satisfied and they just want to, feed straight away and they keep doing that. So they're all different. Different things will impact, if they've had, for example, forceps or a vacuum extraction, they potentially can have a sore head. That can impact on their feeding because they're sore. So there's a number of things that can come into play there. If you're looking at, resuscitation, that can affect as well, their energy levels. So it's not clear cut.
Of course. And so I think it's, again, important for us to make the statement that even though breastfeeding is important nutritionally, immunologically for the bub, that it just isn't as easy for everybody.
No, definitely not. Some people will have, they'll work it out and it just all comes quite easily. Others will have more difficulty, and that's not to say that they're doing anything is wrong. There's a number of different things that can come into play there as well. Things on how the baby latches, have they got a big enough mouth, anatomy of the woman's breasts and nipples. So all of those things can actually affect how successful someone can actually start off with breastfeeding. And it's also it's hard. It's hard work. Women are tired. They've been labouring or, they're recovering from an operative procedure. And then you've got this little person that's wanting to feed and every couple of hours. So, lack of sleep and those things can have can play a part, as well as pain. It takes time for it to be really established. So we try to encourage that with the women. We try to support them in establishing the breastfeeding if that's what they're wanting to do.
From what I've seen with Kel, my partner, it's basically you tell the woman to run a marathon and then you'd say, okay, now after you finish the marathon, don't sleep, and now use whatever energy you have left and give it to somebody else. And it's just women shift, like you said to me, Matt, they shift into another gear. A gear that I just don't have. I don't know how mums do it. I take my hat off to them. And my partner's just shifted into this next gear and is just, luckily feeding quite well. but is just exhausted. It's that exhaustion.
Yeah.
It's just everyone's tired. Bub's tired. Mum's tired. Me to a lesser extent. I don't have to breastfeed, so I'm lucky in regards to that. Maddie, do you have any particular questions you'd like to ask Rose?
Well, I was talking to my mum about this earlier. My mum's part of ABA, which is Australian Breastfeeding Association.
Yep.
And she actually part of her volunteering job is to go out and help with new mothers and so forth. But she made an interesting comment that society's changed a great deal in terms of, you know, in, say, when she was a child and then before that and before that, there were really big families.
Yep.
So, you know, siblings would have exposure to their siblings being breastfed and actually see the process involved. But now in more our day, in the millennials and so forth, we don't generally see breastfeeding in society or from our siblings and so forth. So maybe we have that lack of exposure to what's involved behind it. Do you see that where we just don't have that, or many new mothers just don't exactly know what's involved?
Potentially. I think what can happen is, with the way society is when you've got social media and those type of pressures, you know, a lot of the new mums that are coming through, you know, they've gone through high school, they've, you know, potentially, well-educated women, and, you know, they put a lot of expectations on themselves that they should be able to do this successfully straight away, and they don't realise that it is a lot of work. Like, you are feeding that baby regularly. You need to feed a baby between 8 to 12 times in 24 hours. And so, initially, after delivery, that's, you know, there's not a lot of time there to sleep in between feeds, when some feeds can last for quite a while. Sometimes I think the expectations, not realizing that it is
a lot of hard work.
A lot of hard work that they do struggle with it.
And then all that is normal.
Yeah.
Because they might actually feel in themselves that this is abnormal, I'm different, it's not working for me, I'm stressed.
That's right. And it is extremely normal. And I still always reflect back on my first experience with breastfeeding. And it was very difficult. You know, lots of things happening, tired, attachment issues. Am I doing this right? Confidence issues. That's right. And that's a lot of the experiences that a lot of women actually have. And they don't realize that if they actually spoke to the person next to them who's also breastfeeding, that they're experiencing those same things.
Yeah.
Well, that's something, again, I'm going back to my experience because Bub's new. The fact that Everything that the mum's doing, especially if it's their first bub, is new. Like, it's 100% new. There's no practice to breastfeeding up until bub comes.
Yep.
And so whatever's happening, you're experiencing it for the first time. And sometimes you may have this preconceived idea as to what it should be. For example, a lot of mothers will come in and say, all right, I'm giving birth at this particular point. This is how I want my birth to happen. I'm not going to take any drugs. I'm going to deliver it naturally. And then everything flies out the window. You have a C-section, have an epidural and whatever it may be. And so you have expectations, and then sometimes those expectations aren't met. And I think that's when a lot of people get let down, because they feel as though it's not going to plan. It hasn't worked. But it's not that it hasn't worked. It's just that every plan is different.
Yeah.
That's right. And plans, well, you know, with labour, things can happen very, very different, you know, very rapidly. Things can change and interventions need to occur. And with breastfeeding, it's a learned process. When the baby first starts to feed, it's learning how to feed. It's learning how to attach. It's learning how to do that sucking of nutritively. Then the mum is learning. The mum's learning how to attach their baby independently. They're learning how to hold their baby properly, what works for them, what position is the most viable position for them to effectively feed. And so some women may find that they can't actually sit in a chair and feed, and they have to lie down to feed their baby. And that's fine. It's whatever works for them to be able to do it successfully.
Oh, good.
That's great.
So just quickly, before we move on to, you know, some of the benefits of breastfeeding and then some of the contraindications, so when should mothers potentially not breastfeed, I think we should point out the fact that when bub first comes out and they've got the colostrum and they're feeding, and it's volume-wise, it's not a huge amount. First 24 hours, probably 100-ish mils, and then moving on to, after about 5 days, upwards of 500, 600 mils of milk. That it's very difficult for mothers to be able to gauge their milk production. how much milk they're producing, because you can't actually see. It's going straight from the breast into the bub, and you don't know whether you're producing that 500 mils or 150 mils. So how does a mother know? What are the objective measures that a mother can use to know whether she's producing enough milk for bub?
Okay. Well, in those early stages, we go by a lot of urine output. So if you equate it to day one, one wet nappy, day two, two wet nappies, day three wet nappies, day four wet nappies, day five wet nappies. From then on, when they've gone into that transitional milk phase, they should be producing more, you know, more wet nappies. We should be seeing stools being passed and the change in the colour of their stools as well.
Which Mike pointed out.
Yeah, I pointed out earlier, it starts off with this black tarry stuff, then goes a little bit green and then goes to this mustard yellow.
Yeah, and that mustard yellow, it means that breast milk has come through.
Yeah.
And so it's been, you know, it's getting digested and the babies are then actually putting on weight. While it's still in that meconium poo, they're not actually putting weight on.
Mm.
And so that's why you do see that weight loss in that first couple of days. And
which is about 10%, a bit under 10%.
We like it to be under 10%. Some babies, they don't lose a lot of weight at all. Others may lose a little bit more, but in general it's just under 10%, and that's to be expected,
and that should be regained within a week or two.
Usually if they're exclusively breastfed, it can be up to 3 weeks, but you do normally see that happening very quickly as soon as that milk's come through.
Yeah.
So, for example, if we go and weigh a baby a couple of days after day three, we're already seeing that they're starting to put weight back on.
Okay.
They may not have reached their birth weight, but they are starting to go the other way where they're starting to regain weight.
Perfect.
And to measure once milk is fully in, so when they've got that mature milk, you should be seeing, you know, a number of very good wet nappies during the day, and you should be seeing about 100 to 150 grams per week of weight gain in those early weeks.
Oh, nice. So let's have a look at some of the benefits of breastfeeding. So I've had a look at a couple of meta-analyses, some big studies looking at the benefits of breastfeeding, and they've stated that breastfeeding is actually beneficial not just for bub, but also for mum as well.
Definitely.
So if we have a look at, maybe if we look at bub first and talk about some of the benefits of breastfeeding for bub, and then we can look at some of the benefits for mum. What do you think?
No problem.
Let's start with bub. What do you think, what do you know has been some of the major benefits of breastfeeding?
Well, it helps with digestion, helps protect the gut flora, and helps initiate that immunity for a baby. So you've got passive immunity, which can transfer from mum to baby. So that's really, really important. Breast milk has all that nutritional value. So
and the gut flora has become a huge thing in medicine in terms of having these beneficial bacteria in your digestive tract to then cause systemic effects into the body.
That's right. And they do say that it reduces, you know, the incidence of things like Crohn's disease later in life for children, allergies. So it is really beneficial.
So are these components of the breast milk something that just isn't recapitulated in supplement milk? Is this something that we just don't...
Yeah, it's in, like, you've got different things in breast milk that help it digest more easily for that absorption of nutrients, you know, vitamins, minerals, fatty acids, all of those things that are required. It is all in there in breast milk, and it, you know,
in a readily digestible way too.
Very much so.
Yeah. And what about for mum? What's some of the benefits for mum?
Well, I suppose one of the really good benefits is that they can get back to pre-birth weight fairly quickly, pre-baby weight.
Ah, okay.
So it helps them when they're breastfeeding. They're using a lot of energy, so we do recommend them to have, you know, a normal diet, healthy diet, but they do end up losing, you know, weight and potentially getting back to that pre-baby weight, get rid of that baby weight.
Nice.
It helps with getting them back physiologically, so it helps contracting that uterus down, which is what we want it to do when, you know, after they've delivered.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's because in part the oxytocin that's released, right?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
That's going to help with the milk ejection, but because of its role in smooth muscle contraction, helps the uterine contraction to
occur. That's right.
Bring it back.
Yep.
Cool.
That's correct. You've also got the benefit of, you know, mother and baby bonding. You can't put that, you can't ignore that. It does help that nurturing occur, which is really important for both of them.
So we've got, for bub, we've got some immunological benefits, so protecting bub, gut flora benefits. We've got nutritional benefits.
Yep.
For mum, we've got benefits in regards to going back to pre-baby weight faster, some emotional benefits. Are there any links between that you're aware of postpartum depression and breastfeeding?
That's probably a really hard one to answer because there's...
It's multifactorial, I know.
Okay, it is, because there's a number of things that can come into play there. So you can have women that, you know, may have gone through some type of trauma in their life.
Mm.
So breastfeeding may not actually be appropriate for them because anxiety issues and could lead to postpartum depression.
Yeah.
Where other women who have... a very successful breastfeeding history, it can reduce the risk of postpartum depression. So, you know, it's got to be outweighed for whatever's right for the woman and that child in that particular instance.
I've also read a meta-analysis that came out in Lancet in last year, 2016, and it stated that for nursing women, breastfeeding actually gave them protection against breast cancer, and it improved birth spacing, so time between next bub, and may potentially protect them against ovarian cancer, maybe type 2 diabetes. They scaled this up and they said that scaling up of breastfeeding to a near universal level could potentially prevent 823,000 annual deaths in children younger than 5 years and 20,000 annual deaths from breast cancer. So this is obviously them extrapolating from what they found in their study. Yep. I wouldn't take this as gospel per se, but I mean it's interesting to state that the benefits of breastfeeding are probably more expansive than what you'd initially think.
Oh, definitely. So there is a link between particularly those premenopausal cancers, so your ovarian cancer and breast cancer with breastfeeding. They're really beneficial. Things like, you know, calcium uptake, so those calcium stores in the mum, improving, decreasing the risk of anemia in mum. They've also found that as benefit.
And osteoporosis, I think.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
So from the mother's point of view, is there anything she should eat more of or maybe foods to avoid?
Well, the mum should have just eat a healthy diet.
Supplementation. I'm sorry to interrupt because Kelly, my partner, was told from one of the midwives to think about supplements and supplementing vitamin supplements. Yep. Now, I know that for individuals who are healthy, have a balanced diet, and are not nutritionally or mineral or vitamin deficient in any way, shape, or form, vitamin supplements, mineral supplements aren't beneficial. But obviously, a breastfeeding mother who's just given birth and so forth may be deficient in X, Y, and Z.
Yep.
Is vitamin or mineral supplements something you'd recommend for the breastfeeding mother?
Yeah, we do recommend. So we recommend women to take, you know, vitamin supplements antenatally. So, you know, there's a number of different products out there for breastfeeding and pregnancy vitamins. And something like that is quite suitable for a woman. And we do recommend that they continue to take that while they're breastfeeding. So if you consider, you know, they're using up a lot of energy, the baby is taking a lot of their nutrients and they need to restock those nutrients. If they've had something happen while they were in that intrapartum period when they've, you know, done the delivery, say they've had a hemorrhage or something, they're going to be low in iron. So having those supplements will help, increase their stores again.
Okay. Mm.
But basically just a balanced diet.
A balanced diet is the main thing. Staying away from
hydration,
alcohol, keeping drinking water, you know, have a snack close by when you are breastfeeding because you get...
Okay, that's good.
Hungry.
So are there any contraindications of breastfeeding? So is there anything that if the mother's got maybe an infectious disease or something like that or certain drugs that would contraindicate?
Yeah, there are certain medications and certain conditions that someone may have that they can't breastfeed and those women need just as much the support as someone who can.
Right.
So if you've got, for example, someone who's a HIV carrier, then they can't breastfeed because you don't want that to be transferred across to the baby.
Mm.
If you've got, you know, someone on anti-epileptic drugs, some antipsychotic medications, they just can't be given, or someone who's on cytotoxic medications, they can't breastfeed.
Okay.
Because obviously having a C-section, my partner's on, you know, oxycodone, paracetamol, ibuprofen, you know, a bunch of NSAIDs and so forth, and still breastfeeding. So,
yes.
You know, I assume that, you know, liver first pass is fine. It's not getting into the breast milk. Bub's not getting...
Tiny amounts.
Small amounts?
It's very tiny. But they're only on those medications for a short period of time.
Yeah.
So if you've got someone who's, you know, taking illicit drugs, then you wouldn't be recommending that they're breastfeeding.
Okay.
Because of it passing through the milk to the baby.
Okay. Any other questions you have, Matt?
No, I think they've been pretty much answered from my side.
Is there anything you'd like to finalize? Any points you'd like to make? Any?
I suppose the big thing to remember, like breastfeeding is really beneficial to women, but not all women can breastfeed for whatever reason. So all of those women, whether they breastfeed or choose not to breastfeed, you know, need the same support with whatever decisions they're making and assistance in however they're wanting to feed their babies.
Wonderful.
Great point.
Thank you, Rose. I really appreciate you coming in and having a discussion with us. For those of you who are listening, just a bit of housekeeping. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can follow us on Facebook, which is Dr. Matt, Dr. Mark's Medical Podcast. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter, which is at GU Biosciences. Or you can send us an email, ask us questions, tell us what you'd like us to talk about next time, which is GUBiosciences@gmail.com. You can also visit our YouTube channel and watch some of our YouTube videos where we discuss a number of different anatomy, physiology, pathophysiology, and pharmacology related topics. Thanks, everyone. We'll speak to you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.